geography in sound.
This campaign is more than a contest between two men. It is more than a contest between...
The older I grow, the more I appreciate children. We approach all the problems of childhood with affection.
I was taken from this village to the far west 78 years ago.
The chairman, Major Cooper, and my countrymen. Today we meet...
Herbert Clark Hoover, 31st President of the United States, humanitarian, elder statesman, engineer, born August 10th, 1874, died October 20th, 1964. The National Broadcasting Company presents this special program in tribute to Mr. Hoover, who died in New York this morning following a lengthy illness. Mr. Hoover's body will lie in state in St. Bartholomew's Church in New York until Friday, when it will be taken to Washington. There, in the rotunda of the Capitol, the former president's remains will lie in repose until Sunday, when the body will be flown to West Branch, Iowa, Mr. Hoover's birthplace, for final funeral services and burial. Here is NBC's Ray Henley, a longtime friend of the late president.
Herbert Hoover was 54 years old on the March day in 1929 when he took the oath of office as President of the United States. I was a young reporter assigned to the White House. For me, that inauguration also was the beginning of a warm friendship with the chief, as those of us who knew him well addressed him. That ripened over the 34 long years since then. Mr. Hoover already was a world-famous figure at 54, with two highly successful careers behind him. He had achieved eminence in his profession of mining engineer, and in the process had earned a fortune in true Horatio Alger fashion at a comparatively early age. And he had stirred the admiration and heartfelt gratitude of millions of unfortunate victims of war, famine, and floods around the globe by his tireless direction of relief operations on two continents. Now, in 1929, he was President of the United States, and ahead lay two more careers, as a national and world leader and as an elder statesman, and with it all, a continuation of his humanitarian role. To some, his ascendancy to the highest office in the United States soon was regarded as a disastrous turning point in the heretofore succession of great achievements. But most of Mr. Hoover's staunch friends thought otherwise during the turbulent years of the Great Depression. And historians and even many of his critics, with the aid of hindsight and the passing of new crises, now place Herbert Hoover's role in those tumultuous years in a different perspective. This evening we shall examine the life of this great man and recall Herbert Hoover in his three careers and seek to find his place in history. Herbert Hoover was born in 1874 in the small Midwestern town of West Branch, Iowa. His Quaker father died when the boy was six, and 4 years later his mother passed away. The 10-year-old orphan lad went west to live with an uncle in Salem, Oregon. In a television interview with Mr. Hoover in 1955, he recalled to me what happened next.
Well, this uncle of mine in Oregon was a country doctor, with all of the fine attributes of the country doctors of the United States. I lived with him and his family, part of it, for a matter of about 7 years. And during that time, I got a job as an office boy. And on one occasion, a gentleman having some business with the firm came in, and while he waited, he talked with the office boy. And he was inquiring what I wanted to do so far. And he said, well, you ought to take up engineering. And he was himself an engineer. So we discussed it, and he rather inspired my mind. And soon I noticed that Stanford University had announced that the institution would be opened that autumn, and that tuition would be free. That is more or less fitted my necessity.
I see, sir.
They announced they would hold entrance examinations in Portland, Oregon. I went to the appointed place. I took the examinations as well as I could, not ever having been at a high school, but having attended a night school where I had picked up some Latin and some mathematics. I passed the mathematics examinations with such distinction that the professor conducting the examinations sparked a good deal of interest, sent for me, inquired about my family background. He himself was a Quaker. He was a great professor of mathematics and subsequently was the president of Swarthmore College for many years. But in any event, he said to come down to the university and he'd find a tour. And he thought I could get in, and he also said he'd be glad to help me work my way through the university.
I see. So there really you have two cases, Mr. Hoover, where men, older men, showed a keen interest in a young man trying to get along.
Oh, I have a number of unforgettable obligations to men who took an interest in a youngster. They do it yet all over the United States. There were two, there are many more to follow.
You will hear President Hoover refer again and again, as we listen to more of his conversations in this broadcast, how older men helped him through his early years. I asked Mr. Hoover about his first job after he obtained his diploma.
Well, I had worked during the summer vacations during my entire time in Stanford on the United States Geological Survey. That was what I was a spot where I earned most of the money that I had needed. And after having finished that season, I'm not having a job, that's after I had graduated, I went into the mines at Grass Valley in California. Being familiar with those mines from the previous work I'd done for the Geological Survey, I sought a job and I thought my diploma might be of importance and I might even get on the staff of some mine. But that diploma didn't seem to impress anybody. And finally I got to a condition where I took a job underground in a mine and I worked 5 months, I think, or six, as a common miner. And it was not a bad experience.
Did I understand you to say, sir, that you took a job as a common miner?
Yes, sure.
What kind of mine was this in, sir?
It's a gold mine. I didn't even have the distinction of being a miner. I was started by loading trucks. A miner is a fellow who ran a drill, and I rose to that eminent position some 2 or 3 months later.
I see. How many hours did you work a day there, sir?
Oh, the regulation hours at that time was 10 hours a day and 6 days a week.
Do you remember what you got, how much wages you got?
Oh, you got $2 a day. I think I got 2 1/4 after I was promoted to run a drill.
Well, sir, then on your very first job, you learned how to work with your hands, didn't you?
Well, that wasn't quite the whole story. I worked with my hands when I was a boy. And what I really learned at that time was the agony of walking and going from mine to mine looking for a job.
Well, I take it then that you, during that period, you were able to lay aside a little money for future activities.
Well, I certainly laid enough money aside to get down to San Francisco and look for a better job.
Well, Mr. Hoover, then, how did you happen to get into professional engineering after those underground mining days experience?
Well, I had developed a great friend of Dr. Brenner here at Stanford. He was one of those men who always boosted youngsters along. He introduced me to the leading engineer in San Francisco, Mr. Louis Jannon. Jannon gave me a temporary appointment. He had an application for an engineer to go to Australia. And there I went on my first $10,000 job.
Well, then, subsequently to that, your work took you to countries all over the world, didn't it, Mr. Hoover?
Yes, as a partner in an international engineering firm, We manage mines in China and India and Burma and Australia and Russia. I don't know where all, including the United States and Canada. So that during the first 7 years of this century, I went around the world 7 times with my entire family.
Mr. Hoover had married the former Lou Henry at the turn of the century. Shortly afterwards, the newlyweds found themselves in China, facing grave personal danger. Here he tells about it.
I went to China originally as a part of the engineering firm I've mentioned to you, as the chief engineer to the then Department of Mines. It had been created by a reform government. That job came to an end by the Boxer Uprising, which threw the government out. And Mrs. Hoover and I have to spend a month under artillery and rifle fire in the town of Tientsin until the American Marines came in and rescued us. See.
Mr. Hoover, what do you think now that the communists are in power, what will happen to the Chinese people?
Well, Ray, when the Mao Zedong's armies drove Chiang Kai-shek out of the mainland, the first thing he did was to disarm the Chinese civil population right down to the last butcher knife. And no civil population with pitchforks can ever create a revolution to throw out machine guns. The consequence is that regime is fixed until such a time as the failure of its methods, failure of productivity, should cause the regime itself to change. And no doubt they will have fights amongst the Chinese leaders. They've already shown that. And often enough, revolutions of that kind in history have blown up by fights among the leaders.
In the next few years, Herbert Hoover became the father of 2 sons, Herbert Jr. and Alan, and had reached the pinnacle of success in his professional career, supervising more than 160,000 men all over the world in various mining, railway, and chemical enterprises. As the successful and now wealthy Herbert Hoover passed his 40th birthday, the world approached one of history's greatest cataclysms. I asked him about it.
Mr. Hoover, when did your career as an engineer come to an end?
It came to an end when I, shortly after I took over the Belgian relief in 1914. I didn't know it at the time. We all expected the war would be over very shortly and we'd get back to work. But as the war went on and on, my clients and partners had to have some other interest. So I never went back to the profession.
Do you, who was it who asked you to get into the relief work?
That was the combined pressures of leading Belgians, the Belgian ambassador, the Belgian prime minister, the American ambassador in London, and the American ambassador in Brussels. They all seemed to concentrate on me to undertake that job.
So that this operation carried on during the war, you certainly must have been in some exciting experiences from time to time.
Well, most of it was a pretty humdrum business. You had to transport a tremendous volume of food overseas with a fleet of 300 ships. You had to distribute it, transport it inland, ration the population, and take possession of their agricultural product and so forth. And, in fact, it was the first food administration in the history of the world. The incidents that came out of it were nothing very startling.
That modest shrugging off of a Herculean achievement was typical of the chief. And the project he described so matter-of-factly was only the beginning.
The Belgian relief continued throughout the war, and I continued to conduct it. When we came into war, I withdrew the American staff and substituted Dutch inside of Belgium. At that time, the British and French were beginning to find food difficulties, and they began to call on me for advice. And about that time, President Wilson asked me to take over the United States Food Administration. So I became food administrator of the United States, continued in that until the time of the armistice in 1918. And then I was asked to go to Europe on behalf of all of the Allied governments to take over the rehabilitation of the food supply of some 350 million people in Eastern Europe.
It is impossible to accurately calculate in cold statistics just what Herbert Hoover accomplished in the 9 years during and after the First World War that he was engaged in this tremendous relief work. Certainly many millions of starving Europeans were fed through his efforts. Then, as the post-war relief project was about to be liquidated, a new crisis appeared in the East.
A dreadful drought struck South Russia in 1923. Maxim Gorky, on behalf of the communist government, appealed to me to undertake some American help. I organized the operation. We sent some 200 Americans into Russia. They gave them completely free movement. I raised, plus congressional appropriations, about $70 million of American money, and we unquestionably saved about 17 million Russian lives. They accredited us with that. And when we finished, they got out a very beautiful scroll addressed to me and the American people of gratitude in Russian. But when the American communists get too entirely abusive, I send out a photograph of it in translation by way of stopping them up a little.
Ironically, and typical of the communist attitude toward their capitalist rival, Moscow revised its official view of this great American rescue effort directed by Mr. Hoover, so that within a few years, the famine relief project was described by the Soviet Union as a sly effort by the West to plant spies in Russia. Even the Soviet Encyclopedia, which for a few years carried a glowing account of Mr. Hoover's great work in the famine, now makes no mention of the great rescue operation which cost this country $75 million and probably saved as many as 20 million Russian lives. Before he was elected president in 1928, Mr. Hoover served for 8 years as Secretary of Commerce. During that time, he was called on once more to go to the aid of starving masses, this time at home. A great flood swept the Mississippi River Valley in 1927, driving scores of thousands from their homes. The Commerce Secretary took personal charge of rescue and relief operations, and not only provided emergency feeding for the victims, but later was proud to recall that this massive undertaking was accomplished at no cost to the United States taxpayer. Then, in 1929, shortly after taking office, the Great Depression struck, throwing millions out of work. We will examine that complex phase of the president's career later, but let's listen now to his description of relief efforts and note how Mr. Hoover, 25 years later, characterizes the creation of the economic crash and the actions of his successor in the White House.
Unemployment across grew with the Depression, and especially when the whole economy of Europe collapsed and brought us down. And I organized relief in the United States. At the time I left office, we had about 18 million people on relief in the United States. And Mr. Roosevelt found he had to continue the same number up until about Pearl Harbor.
Since we now are reviewing Mr. Hoover's career as a humanitarian, we skip to 1945, when Harry S. Truman was the nation's chief executive. Mr. Hoover, after he had left the White House, had been in virtual eclipse as far as public service. Here he recalls what happened then.
It was not until the war was over, when the inevitable post-war famine began, that I again was called back into service. Bear in mind that every world war will create a worldwide famine. I don't need to go into the reasons for that, but it's a solemn fact, and Mr. Truman was faced with a famine in 1946, even greater than the world has ever seen before. He asked me to take a part in the management of the famine, and I did so by organizing the necessary setup in Washington, and again, I visited 38 different nations by plane, organized their food administrations, got their cooperation, and in the end, we pulled through. When we started, we were convinced that at least 800 million people would die in that famine. But we found a sort of a widow's cruise of food all over the world that we hadn't expected. And in the end, we pulled them all through. There was no mass starvation anywhere that I know of.
It is a measure of the two men and the nature of our unique American society that Republican Herbert Hoover and Democrat Harry Truman, largely as a result of this joint venture, became the closest of friends, as Mr. Truman himself explained movingly during a testimonial ceremony for the 31st president last year.
He did a job for me that nobody else in the world could have done. He kept millions of people from starving to death after the Second World War, just as he did after the First World War for Woodrow Wilson. And when I asked him if he would be willing to do the job, he never hesitated one minute. He said, "Yes, Mr. President, I'll do it." And he did. Most wonderful job in keeping these people from starving. And what more can a man do? What more can a man do? I've always been fond of him. And of course, after he saved all these people from starving, I feel that I'm one of his closest friends, and he's one of my closest friends.
One final insight into Mr. Hoover's feeling about children, to whom he directed most of his great humanitarian efforts over the many years. He reads a philosophical reflection from his memoirs.
"The older I grow, the more I appreciate children. We approach all the problems of childhood with affection. Theirs is the province of joy and of good humor. They are the most wholesome part of the race. They are the sweetest, for they are fresher from the hands of God. Whimsical, ingenious, mischievous, we live a life of apprehension as to what their opinion may be of us, a life of defense against their terrifying energy. We put them to bed with a sense of relief and a lingering of devotion. We envy them the freshness of adventure and the discovery of life. We mourn over the disappointments which they will meet."
Another project close to Mr. Hoover's heart is the Boys Club of America, of which he was board chairman. Here is Albert Cole, president of the Boys Club, recalling Mr. Hoover's personal association and interest in the National Youth Project.
"Mr. Hoover's father died when he was 6, and his mother when he was 8. He then went to live with an uncle in Newburgh, Oregon. He often talked of his boyhood and never lost interest in other boys or in the things that meant most to them. Over the years, I've been present often when Boys Club boys have visited Mr. Hoover. I've been impressed repeatedly by the fact that it has taken only a few minutes for every boy to realize that here was a man who had sympathy for his interests and his enthusiasms. It was no problem for Mr. Hoover to establish a bond of friendship and sympathy with a boy. He was chairman of the board of the Boys Clubs of America for over a quarter of a century, during which time he missed only a total of 4 board meetings, 2 because he was abroad and 2 because of illness. Since his retirement from public office, his interest in helping the underprivileged boy was one activity from which he derived great satisfaction. His passing will be a great loss to the boys of America."
That is Herbert Hoover, humanitarian. Just a few brief glimpses into that vigorous, tireless, conscientious side of a great man of many parts.
Mr. Henley will continue this special program in commemoration of the late President Herbert Hoover after we pause 10 seconds for station identification.
Herbert Hoover, 31st President of the United States. For years, this separate and distinguished career of the great engineer, the tireless humanitarian, was clouded in controversy. It began during the bitter 1928 presidential campaign. Mr. Hoover was nominated by the Republicans on the first ballot. The Democrats named New York Governor Alfred E. Smith. Two bitter issues swirled around the contestants, one out in the open, with both men stoutly espousing conflicting opinions, the other swept viciously along in whispers and clandestine literature. Both men vehemently tried to squelch this latter fire, never wholly succeeded. Governor Smith denounced prohibition, urged repeal of the 18th Amendment, which banned alcoholic beverages. Mr. Hoover defended the dry laws as an experiment noble in purpose, and personally took the position that a president constitutionally has no part in changing what is written into the Constitution. That was the issue they debated and orated about. But the behind-the-scenes issue revolved around religion. Al Smith was a Roman Catholic and the first man of his faith to seek the presidency. Mr. Hoover was a Quaker, with all the gentility and tolerance which characterizes that faith. He vainly tried to head off a wave of bigotry which infected areas of the nation. But there is no doubt that misled anti-Catholic zealots of both political parties, and particularly within the Democratic Solid South, greatly accelerated the New York governor's landslide defeat in 1928. Against this background of bitterness, Mr. Hoover took office, determined to lead the nation to an even greater period of prosperity based on sounder economic and welfare principles than the good times the nation had been enjoying in the late 20s. But within 7 months, the nation was to be rocked to its very foundations when its economy collapsed like a punctured balloon, starting what has been called the Great Depression. You'll recall Mr. Hoover's remarks, which we heard earlier in this broadcast, that the Depression was a European import. In his memoirs, he expands on that analysis in these words. He said, "Many of my hopes in public life were interrupted by the Great Depression, a product of some misdeeds of our own, but in the main a penalty of a great war and its impacts on Europe. The European economic hurricane, when it reached our shores, compelled me to turn my attention in part from national development and needed reforms to the defense of our economic and social life. Moreover, the wounds of the Depression opened our flesh deeply to collectivist infections from Europe." Unquote. Here is Mr. Hoover's voice in a 1949 speech reflecting along similar lines.
In 1932... I was the fellow that had to suffer from the first unbalanced budget in many years. Our modest deficit was about $1 billion. And in the midst of this grief, Mr. Roosevelt, in denouncing our deficit, as all deficits ought to be denounced, made an uncomfortable remark to the effect that too often liberal governments have been wrecked on the rock of deficits. However, he only made that remark once. About that time, Lord John Maynard Keynes came up with his new intoxicant of deficit spending in years of unemployment. It had a good political flavor, and having got the habit, we kept drinking in times of presumed prosperity. And with the exception of 2 years, we have had deficits and increasing debt for all of the 17 years since Mr. Keynes came to the United States to help us out.
And so the Great Depression raged on, smashing the economy and driving much of the populace to the edge of despair. In the spring of 1932, a motley group of World War I veterans left Seattle, Washington, bound for Washington, D.C., where they half-seriously planned to petition bodily for an immediate payment of a service bonus already approved by Congress for payment years later. The idea caught on among the jobless, dissatisfied men around the country, and soon tens of thousands of angry, destitute men were camped throughout the capital, demanding Congress approve the payment promptly. At Mr. Hoover's suggestion, Congress appropriated funds for transportation home for the Bonus Expeditionary Force, as the loosely organized bands of demonstrators called themselves. Some 6,000 took advantage of the government's offer and returned home, but several thousand more remained and eventually had to be forcibly evicted from a squalid shanty town on the Anacostia Flats by regular soldiers under the then Army Chief of Staff, General Douglas MacArthur. A congressional investigation years later provided testimony by one of the leaders of this remnant group of the Bonus Army that their operations actually were directed from Moscow through a Red headquarters set up in a Washington hotel room. Mr. Hoover, for years afterwards, was blamed for the riots connected with the ouster of the Bonus marchers. Some even called him a killer because one of the demonstrators was slain during the riotous eviction. And this remained a bitter memory for Mr. Hoover throughout the remainder of his life. Fighting on the economic front, of course, became the president's major preoccupation through his 4 years in the White House. But he was busy, nevertheless, in other fields. He and his Secretary of State, Henry Stimson, evolved the doctrine of non-recognition of any gains from aggression in an effort to blunt the Japanese drive into Manchuria in 1931. He helped put Europe on the way to economic recovery by declaring a moratorium on the huge war debts nations overseas had incurred. He embarked on a huge federal building project to help ease unemployment and give the economy a boost. He established the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the Federal Farm Board. And he directed the operations of the Wickersham Commission in its study of law enforcement in connection with Prohibition. A man who is familiar with another law enforcement project, John Lord O'Brien, a Washington attorney, who then was in the Department of Justice, recalls that study.
During all of his administration, I was acting as the first assistant to the Attorney General, and in particular, in charge of the enforcement of the antitrust laws. At no time during those years did Mr. Hoover make any attempt, directly or indirectly, to influence the policy of the Department of Justice. One of his outstanding characteristics was the trust and confidence that he reposed in the men whom he selected for office, both in domestic affairs and in his administration of foreign affairs. He was characterized always by the same singleness of purpose, the same unselfish personal attitude.
Lewis L. Strauss knew Mr. Hoover longer than any of the men now living who worked with Mr. Hoover. After a half century of intimate association, Admiral Strauss says,
I have known Herbert Hoover for nearly half a century. During all those years, I was privileged to work with him and to observe him in triumph and disaster, his great character far superior to the influence of either event. Though extremely shy and sensitive, he possessed an inner strength which fortified him against the assaults of his detractors. Looking down the corridor of the years at the life of this man of such humble origins, a life so crowded with good deeds on a heroic scale and with countless unrecorded acts of individual benevolence, it is hard to choose among the qualities for which one might revere him most. But for me, these stand forth: his love of justice, his compassion for the defenseless, for the oppressed, the starving, the weak, the hurt, for all of these, and especially for children. His abhorrence of personal hatred, for he lived without malice toward any man. His unshakable belief in the future of our country and the principles upon which it was founded. 40 years ago, he sent me an essay closing with these lines. Humanity has a long road to perfection, but we of America can make sure progress if we will preserve our individualism, if we will preserve and stimulate the initiative of our people, if we will build up our insistence and safeguards to equality of opportunity, if we will glorify service as a part of our national character. Progress will march if we hold an abiding faith in the intelligence, the initiative, the character, the courage, and the divine touch in the individual. We can safeguard these ends if we give to each individual that opportunity for which the spirit of America stands. We can make a social system as perfect as our generation merits, and one that will be received in gratitude by our children. Rereading these words, they seem to me the testament of a great American to us all.
Mr. Hoover regarded as a lasting monument to his work the creation of the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. Here is its director, Mr. W. Glenn Campbell.
It is almost 50 years since Herbert Hoover started to build an institution devoted to the study of war, revolution, and peace on the campus of his alma mater, Stanford University. The initial inspiration for the Hoover Institution came when Mr. Hoover was engaged in his first great humanitarian enterprise, organizing and directing the operation that saved a whole nation, the Belgians, from starvation during World War I. Because of the war, a wholesale destruction of books and documents, and even whole libraries, was taking place. Mr. Hoover resolved not to let the same thing happen to the records of the First World War, and started the document collecting activities that have since been expanded to cover the various revolutions and wars, peace negotiations, and the vast economic and social changes of the 20th century. Today, the Hoover Institution has become a world-famous center for the study of political and economic change in the 20th century. Thousands of scholars and policymakers from the United States and abroad have used its resources and facilities. Out of these studies have come important contributions to knowledge and to public policy, as well as to the safe growth of the American way of life. The primary focus of the Hoover Institution's work is on the problem of how to secure and maintain peace. This is in keeping with the expressed aim of Herbert Hoover, who at the dedication of the Tower Building on the Stanford campus in June 1941 stated, "The purpose of this institution is to promote peace. Its records stand as a challenge to those who promote war. They should attract those who search for peace." In the founding and building of this institution, Mr. Hoover exhibited foresight of the highest order and a degree of vision that few persons ever equal in a lifetime of endeavor. And this is only one among his scores of great public service achievements. I first met Mr. Hoover shortly after he had passed his 85th birthday, when we held our first discussions about the Hoover Institution and its work in the fall of 1959. He was a man with an enormous range of knowledge, including particularly extensive and unmatched wisdom in public and international affairs. Above all, however, he was a warm and considerate human being, and contrary to many reports, a person who possessed a keen sense of humor. Finally, I want to say that the greatest privilege of my life has been to know and enjoy the confidence and friendship of Herbert Hoover. He was the greatest American of the 20th century.
In 1932, with the Depression still running unchecked, the Bonus March still a fresh, bitter memory, Herbert Hoover was nominated by the Republicans for re-election, running against another New York governor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Here is Mr. Hoover in a fighting campaign speech which contains the key elements of his re-election platform.
This campaign is more than a contest between two men. It is more than a contest between two parties. It is a contest between two philosophies of government. We are told by the opposition that we must have a change, that we must have a new deal. It is not the change that comes from the normal development of national life to which I object or you object, but the proposal to alter the whole foundations of our national life, which have been built through generations of testing and struggle and of principle upon which we have made this nation.
But the depression and the magnetic attraction to the unhappy masses by the dynamic man from the Empire State overwhelmed Herbert Hoover. Roosevelt ran up a plurality even greater than Hoover's margin over Alfred Smith 4 years earlier. Mr. Hoover accepted defeat gracefully, even made the unprecedented gesture of inviting the incoming president to take part in important decisions in the last months of his administration. But Governor Roosevelt declined, and Mr. Hoover forever after felt that this placed an unfair burden on him as his tenure ran out, preventing him from taking any concrete steps toward economic recovery, which he felt could have been successfully taken in cooperation with the then Democratic House of Representatives. When Mr. Hoover left the White House in 1933, he walked into virtual obscurity for a time. He remained ready to serve his country in any public service capacity. But the call never came from the new man at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. After a year of silence, Mr. Hoover finally began speaking out in public appearances and writings. But his role remained just that, an elder statesman of the opposition party throughout the Roosevelt administration. It was not until 1945, as we have heard earlier, that the call to service did come, this time from a new president, Harry S. Truman. After this work under Mr. Truman in post-war relief, a new chore was given to this tireless statesman. Here he tells about it.
This government of ours multiplied itself from about 600,000 officials up to 2,500,000 as the result of 23 years of war and trouble. And it multiplied its budget from $3.5 billion to as high as $75 billion. With a growth of government agencies from about 300 up to some 1,600, and a fabulous waste and duplication and lack of efficiency. So that the Congress, with the approval of the President in each case, set up a commission. In both cases, I was asked to take the chairmanship. The first reorganization commission secured the adoption of a great many of its recommendations, about 70% in fact. They related largely to reorganization of the different agencies and setting up a new structure of the government. The Korean War and the rearmament came along and obscured whatever savings there were. The second commission examined the government from a functional and a policy point of view. And we have made recommendations which, if adopted, would enable the balancing of the budget and a very substantial reduction in taxes. The last commission required 5 years to get its proposals adopted. It may take us some years to get these, but I feel certain that they will come.
And many recommendations of the Hoover Commission were approved, and as a result, some $3 billion a year of the taxpayers' money already is being saved. It is estimated that still more can be saved if officials in Washington ever put all of the Hoover Commission's recommendations fully into practice. Perhaps an even more significant contribution to good government, if history can teach good government, was Mr. Hoover's foresight in erecting two great libraries. The Hoover Institution on War, Peace, and Revolution, located at the Leland Stanford University, Palo Alto, California, is a repository of the world's greatest collection dealing with the rise of fascist and communist governments. These priceless documents teach a somber lesson to free governments and free peoples. with funds contributed by the university and from private sources. The Hoover Institution already is graphically showing the pitfalls which befall people who tend to stray from freedom's way. The other great collection is at the Hoover Library at West Branch, Iowa. Like other presidential libraries, this will contain all of Mr. Hoover's personal papers and will be operated as a government institution with government funds. Here, historians of the future can go if they would seek out the true Herbert Hoover and the true worth of his life's works. The boards of trustees of both the Hoover Institution at Palo Alto and the Hoover Library at West Branch presently are staffed with many men who knew Mr. Hoover intimately and who fully understand his own views as to the purpose and objectives these libraries should follow and seek. Herbert Hoover, the man. What was he like? How did he spend his leisure time in these later years when the cares of office and troubled humanity no longer occupied him full time? Here he discusses one of his favorite pastimes.
I have a yen for fishing because the ripple of a brook and the slap of the wave against the side of the boat will brainwash most anybody into a much cleaner position, huh?
Didn't you once make a very famous statement about fishing?
Well, I don't know. I've said a lot about it. I explained that why presidents fish, all went fishing, they all have, even though they never fished before. And that was because the American people have respect for privacy only on two occasions. One of them is prayer and the other is fishing. And presidents can't pray all the time.
And what about his other activities during the last years? He explained with a twinkle in his eyes to reporters who interviewed him on his 87th birthday 3 years ago.
Now, aside from several public addresses on the Karl Marx infection among the American people and a little fishing, I have tried to retire into a monastery known as 31A Waldorf Tower. Now, the purpose is not that of ancient monks to illuminate the margins of old manuscripts, but to write new ones. And so, that is my major occupation.
At that same news conference, this exchange near the end exemplifies the chief's philosophical wisdom and his innate kindness.
You look better than ever on your 87th birthday. How do you feel?
Well, I feel as good as a man can feel when he's 87, but he has limitations.
Mr. Hoover, some people are rather amazed at your activities. You don't seem to be slowing down at all.
The only way to lead a satisfactory life when you get old is not to retire, but to keep at work, doing something.
Thank you very much, Chief.
All right, gentlemen. You do me a great courtesy when you come here to do all this.
That was August 10th, 1961. In the spring of 1963, Mr. Hoover made his final public appearance, and typically he was lured against his doctor's advice to do honor to a young American. Lured by his great loves, youth and America. It was at the Waldorf Astoria at a luncheon in honor of Major L. Gordon Cooper, the astronaut who had just completed 22 orbits of the Earth. Although he appeared pale and unsteady, his speech obscured by age, his voice nonetheless betrayed the fever of his emotion and the depth of his pride.
Mr. Chairman, Major Cooper, and my countrymen. Today we meet here under a very rare occasion in our American history. Our country's heritage is rich in achievements of the pioneer exploring spirit. Every American school child knows the names of our great pioneer explorers. Lewis and Clark, Peary, Lindbergh, Admiral Byrd, and now our astronauts, Shepard, Griscom, Glenn, Carpenter, Sherrod, Slayton, each of these men has added pride and strength of spirit and character and greater learning to our country and has inspired our youth to greater ambition. We now add another great and illustrious name. There could be no greater tribute than this to any man from the American people. And there could be no greater service to our people by any man. Thank you.
In thinking of Mr. Hoover and what his epitaph well might be, only the well-known, tried, and true words and phrases come to my mind. Integrity, high purpose, confidence in his fellow men, love of his country. Yes, above all, love of his country. Mr. Hoover had faith in the United States and in the American system. He never lost this in times of the greatest stress when men with weaker underpinnings of faith surely would have succumbed to doubt. He believed in the destiny of America and was confident she would lead the world to true, full, and complete liberty and justice for all men of all races and creeds. He asked only that the system which raised him from a farmer's orphan to the pinnacles of power, wealth, and influence securely be maintained. Here in Mr. Hoover's own voice, you hear him express these sentiments on his 88th birthday.
I was taken from this village to the far west 78 years ago. The only material assets which I had were two dimes in my pocket, the suit of clothes that I wore, and I had some extra underpinnings provided by loving aunts. But I carried from here something much more precious. I had a certificate of the fourth or the fifth grade, I've forgotten which, of higher learning from the West Branch School. I had a stern grounding of religious faith. I carried with me recollections of a joyous childhood where the winter snow and the growing crops of Iowa were an especial provision for kids. And I carried with me the family disciplines of hard work. That included picking potato bugs at 10 cents a hundred. Now, incidentally, that money was used for the serious purpose of buying firecrackers to applaud the founding fathers on each 4th of July. May I say to the boys and girls of America that the doors of opportunity are still open to you. Today, the durability of freedom is more secure in your country than any place in the world. May God bring you even more great blessings.
And now this is Ray Henley. Good evening.
This has been a special memorial program in honor of the late Herbert Hoover, 31st President of the United States. This program was written and produced by James L. Holton and directed by Lawrence Cirillo.
This is the NBC Radio Network.